From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiatakis with a show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Today, we're headed to the city of Orange, in the northern part of Orange County, where the public school district is echoing national debates over what kids learn in school and how much control their parents have.
My children are mine, not a ward of the state.
I saw something that really concerned me about the gender identity stuff.
We need to get back to basics and focus on academics rather than politicizing, sexualizing, and confusing our children.
CRT, vaccine conspiracies, sex in our schools, all the QAnon stuff.
It's been suggested that we indoctrinate children through sex education. We don't. It's been suggested that we are a bunch of liberals. We aren't.
Tensions have been brewing at the school board for years, fed by Trump-era politics, California curriculum mandates, and pandemic policies such as school closures and masking. But it all came to a head in January when a newly elected conservative majority voted to fire the superintendent. So how did we get here? KCRW's Robin Estrin has the story.
Politically, the Orange Unified School District could be described as a purple community. But recently, the boardroom hasn't felt purple. Instead, it's both very red and very blue. In November, the political balance tipped to the right with the election of a new school board member named Madison Miner. During the campaign, she was endorsed by Southern California megachurch pastor Jack Hibbs.
So let's pray. Let's pray together. Father, we pray right now for Madison Miner. God, she represents you. She loves you. And Father, we pray that you would use her powerfully. And Lord, that you would just do a great work in the Orange County Unified School District. We know
one of Madison Miner's top priorities is the sex ed curriculum. It was passed by the previous board after an 18-month review by parents, teachers, and medical experts. Here's Miner.
That's my biggest issue, is the transparency, the fact that you can't opt your child out of the gender ideologies. It's a little bit one-sided when it comes to all parents' beliefs and all families', you know, morals and integrity.
There's no curriculum called gender ideologies. Minor means teaching the difference between gender and biological sex. But what she says about not being able to opt out is true. Under California Ed Code, parents can opt kids out of a lot of sex ed, but they can't opt kids out of lessons about gender, gender identity, and sexual orientation. Minor has other issues, too. Test scores fell in Orange Unified during the pandemic, like they did in school districts across the country. But Miner and her supporters blame the district for straying away from things like math, literacy, and what she calls true history.
Getting back to basics with our education and giving these kids a chance with good, solid curriculum would be a really good thing.
The new board majority moved quickly to enact its vision for the district. Over winter break, with only 24 hours notice to the public, the board majority made a big decision. They voted to fire the district superintendent and put the assistant superintendent on leave. Both were out of town. The board majority also appeared to have their replacements ready to go. They were appointed that night. Parents were not happy.
This is the opposite of listening to parents and giving them voice.
I thought I was in a democracy. But when I see what is happening here, I think I am in the Soviet Union. You fire people who don't think like you. You don't give notice in advance. You don't give reasons.
I have never been shaking this hard standing at a microphone.
It wasn't just parents who were upset. The board still has three members who disagree with the majority.
So they want to have public dollars, but have no public control. So the state pays for it, but the state has no say in it. That's what they want, ultimately.
This is board member Kristen Erickson, who's been fighting the board's right-wing members all winter.
And so, you know, that's just a bigger public policy issue. Is that how we're going to have an education system? I mean, that doesn't make any sense, and it's not really good for a democratic society.
Since then, things have only gotten worse. In early February, district parent Gregory Pleasant filed a legal complaint, alleging that the board majority had violated transparency laws.
Well, the update is that the board did not respond, the board majority. And so I intend to pursue litigation on the matter.
Around the same time, the new superintendent temporarily suspended the district's online library app after a parent said her child had access to an age-inappropriate book. This turned up the heat for already anxious parents.
Sir, please take your seat. Please take your seat. Please take your seat.
I want to be heard.
Please take your seat.
I am not going to take my seat.
I can have...
At a seven-hour board meeting, many decried book banning.
Then you are simply censoring books that you personally find to be objectionable and imposing your decision on all OUSD parents while mumbling the words parents' choice in hopes that we won't notice what you're doing.
In response, school board president Rick Ledesma turned the issue to protecting kids.
Anytime you hear book banning, you think, no, it's about do not hijack my child's innocence. That's what that parent was talking about. Not about book banning. Keep that in mind, because that's what's going to be heard all night long. Book banning. Not about a child's innocence.
2 weeks later, the interim superintendent resigned. And then this month, the worst meeting yet. The hostility that adults had so far directed at each other turned to a high school student. Ruby Hewitt is a senior in Orange Unified and one of five student board members.
I am like kind of your typical AP honor student. I'm on the dance team at my school. I am one of the captains. I'm on ASB, so I'm the elections commissioner and the student board representative.
Hewitt had watched the tense meetings for months, and she spoke out against the board majority's decision-making several times. On this night, things got out of hand after a man in a red Make America Great Again hat walked into the boardroom holding a video camera.
Good evening, Orange Unified School District board members. My name is Brian Vea, and I'm here today to talk about things that I disagree with that are going on in the California system of education. Critical race theory, that has no business in public education. We also disagree with California sexual education and the way it's being implemented. Parents, you lose control of your kids when you drop them off at school. They become wards of the state because at 12 years
old... Vea directed the camera at the dais, where Hewitt sat with the other board members. She was uncomfortable and texted her dad in the audience. He asked Vea to stop, but Vea refused. So Hewitt spoke up.
If you have been asked not to film students, kids, one of us whom is a minor, I would really appreciate if you respected that request.
Then a woman sitting in the audience yelled something that made Hewitt's stomach turn.
Properly.
There's no safe spaces. There's no safe spaces.
Please.
From there, Hewitt remembers a lot of shouting and teachers running to the front of the room to shield her. She started to cry. Hewitt says now that in that moment, she felt alone.
I'm in this room full of all of these adults and like none of them care that I'm uncomfortable and none of them care about my general safety or well-being. They were right. It's not a safe space, you know, but it's because they're not making it one.
As of this recording, trust between board members has eroded. Parents have mounted a recall effort, there is still no permanent superintendent, and there's a lawsuit looming regarding how the board majority fired the last one. Hewitt says she's not too optimistic about anyone finding common ground.
I think that you should try and see both sides, and you should look at different points of view and all that kind of stuff. But I think that in this particular situation, I had always really pushed myself to be like, let's try and trust that people have general decency first and then kind of go from there. And I'm in this place now where I'm like, it's really hard for me to trust that you have the best interest in mind.
She says it's only gotten harder for her to see both sides. And for the adults in the room who see the stakes as protecting democracy and protecting children, there's not a lot of interest in finding common ground. For KCRW, I'm Robin Estrin.
Well, Well, that kind of reporting is powered by you. Wow, what a story, too. All the nuance there. It takes a lot of effort to put something like that together. And it's powered by you. It's powered by thousands of members who donate every month to KCRW, folks all around Greater LA and around the country and world, utilizing the service, enjoying it, being informed, as evidenced right there by it, during KCRW's Spring Pledge Drive.
Hello, KCRW. Thank you so much for all of you who put together this shining beacon of light that so many of us in the city and world now, thanks to technology, look forward to. I've been listening to you my entire life, and that's never going to change. Thanks again. Love you all.
And we love you back, and thank you for listening all your life to KCRW. You support NPR News and handpicked music and more. And most importantly, count yourself in right now at kcrw.com/give. If we're going to stay on track to end the drive tomorrow and reach the goal, we're hoping for 10 new members an hour. If you've never given before, and you can right now, think about it. Cross over that threshold. Become an active supporter of KCRW. It is your station. We're connected to you, and we have been in LA for decades. If you're just like that gentleman who has been listening all his life, we're a part of your life. You get the service, you get the news, you get the music, all of it, the things that you need, that you rely on, that you're entertained by at KCRW each and every day. And this time around, we're sweetening the deal, too, with a brand new iPhone 14 to seal the deal. If you donate before midnight tonight, you'll automatically be entered to win this one-day offer. So you've got great odds to do it. KCRW.com/give. And thank you, thank you, thank you for your support.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. More rain is in the forecast for overnight tonight and the next few days. Again, it's been one of the wettest streaks in recorded California history. But up until the last few months, it was the driest on record in California for the past 3 years, which prompted state and local officials to tell you to cut down on your water use. So then with all this recent rain, one big question floats to the surface.
Are we out of the drought? Is the drought over in the state of California? And what I want to affirm your instinct that it should be, it feels like it is and continues to be complicated.
That was an answer non-answer from Governor Gavin Newsom recently announcing the rollback of several executive orders regulating water usage in light of the recent deluge. So what will this policy pivot mean for Southern California? Haley Smith is a reporter at the LA Times who covers drought and climate change, and she's with us right now. Hi, Haley.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
You bet. During 3 years, I mean bone dry here. You could go weeks without rain, even in the wet season. And then all of a sudden, the winter of 2022-2023 happens, the rains start, atmospheric rivers. So then what mandates did Newsom roll back?
Right. So the statewide drought emergency that Newsom issued in October 2021 had something like 80 different provisions in it. Among them, there was the governor's call for everyone to reduce their water use by 15%. There was also a requirement that urban water suppliers activate level 2 of their water shortage contingency plan, which basically means preparing for a shortage of at least 20%. So what he did on Friday was he lifted a lot of the strictest provisions, including those two, but he left about 30 of them in place. And that includes things like you're still not allowed to water your lawn within 48 hours of a rainstorm. You still can't use a hose without a shutoff nozzle. There's also a ban on watering non-functional turf at commercial and industrial properties. So basically like grass medians in front of buildings that serve no real purpose. So overall, this was a pretty sweeping move from the governor. And it was almost a response completely to the wet winter that you just described. But there are still some components of the drought order in place.
I mean, political expedience, right, is that people see that it's raining, right? People see that there's been a lot of it. And it's like, you know, why do we have to struggle so hard if we're doing okay?
Yeah, I think it can be very frustrating for people to see things like record deep snowpack and rushing rivers and still say, well, why are we still in a drought? Why won't he just declare it over? And I think there's two reasons for that. That sort of makes sense. And as the governor said, it is nuanced and a little bit complicated. But first, there are still parts of the state that are experiencing acute water shortages. That would be parts of the Klamath Basin in far northern California, parts of the Colorado River Basin in southern California. So, of course, the governor has to think about the whole state when he makes these kinds of decisions. The other reason, which I think is really important, is that the emergency declaration gives the state the power to help local areas. For example, providing bottled water supplies to people in the Central Valley who still don't have safe, clean water coming out of their taps. So those provisions in the emergency order allow for a certain amount of aid, and that's why he doesn't want to lift them completely.
Let's talk a little bit about where the water situation is right now, what it might mean going forward.
It's pretty remarkable. I mean, if you look at the U.S. drought monitor from a year ago, California was like completely colored in shades of dark red and purple, indicating really, really severe and exceptional drought conditions. And now, 1 year later, something like 65% of the state is no longer classified in drought at all. The snowpack statewide is like 2 times its normal amount right now. And in the Southern Sierra, it's about 3 times as normal. So it's really remarkable to see. A lot of our reservoirs and rivers are really full. And officials this week in Southern California actually began refilling Diamond Valley Lake, which is our largest reservoir here in Southern California, because there's just such a surplus of surface water. The caveat there is that groundwater, which is the water that fills the sort of the basins and the aquifers beneath our feet, is still pretty depleted, and it takes more than one wet winter to really recharge those supplies.
Well, let's talk about that, because before the 3 years of the driest on record, right, we had a couple of years of really wet seasons, wet winters. So, I mean, this seems like sort of, dare I say this pun, the ebbs and flows of climate change, of...
Yeah.
I mean, how do you look at this, right?
What we are seeing is that climate change is unhinging a lot of historic patterns and making extremes more extreme. So we're seeing these long bouts of severe dryness punctuated by bursts of extreme wetness, kind of like what happened this winter. And so the point is that we're dealing with this sort of weather whiplash, and the state's water managers are having to increasingly prepare for both drought and flooding at the same time. So there's a lot going on right now, and it seems more likely than not that this sort of trend will continue and probably get worse in the years to come.
And so places are having to think, like places like LA are having to think of different ways of getting water, or water, you know, stormwater capture.
Yeah, absolutely. I think water independence is the name of the game here. We need to become more self-reliant. That includes, as you mentioned, improving our stormwater capture capabilities. It also means investing in things like recycled water facilities so that we're not just flushing water down the drain and never seeing it again. There's ways that we can clean it and reuse it. We do need to think about how to adapt and move forward with a little bit more self-reliance when it comes to our water supplies.
Haley Smith, reporter for the LA Times, covering drought and climate change. Haley, as always, nice to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great that all that water is refilling reservoirs, and once thirsty flowers are about to super bloom, and the drought monitor shows much better news. But goodness, all these clouds and rain and the cold for Southern California anyway, can be depressing. In more extreme climates, shorter winter days can induce what's known as seasonal affective disorder, or SAD for short. But SoCal seasons are typically awards and pilot season, not really winter and summer. So this kind of thing seems weird to talk about for us. Dr. Michael Gitlin is director of the Outpatient Mood Disorders Program over at UCLA. Doctor, welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Talk a little bit about seasonal affective disorder. It's not necessarily about the weather, right? It's about daylight.
That's correct. In Southern California, we certainly have what's called a circumannual variation in the length of the day. The sun goes down much earlier in December than it does in June here. We have less variability in temperature. We have relatively warm winters, of course, not as warm as summer, but not as dramatically different. And it is generally thought that it's the length of the sunlight of day that correlates with seasonal depression. So you see it more in cities like Anchorage or Seattle than you would in Southern California. But nonetheless, we have it here too. And it typically comes on starting around late October, early November. And it, whether you treat it or not, it typically goes away by March or early April as the days get longer, as they already are here. And that really is different than the gloomy mood that is relatively transient if you have a few days of rain. So I think we need to make a distinction between feeling gloomy because, you know, it's raining out for a bit versus true seasonal depression, which is based specifically on the length of the daylight.
Do you see more of those disorders in a place like Seattle just because of the gloomy weather? And, you know, when the sun is blocked by clouds and there's rain, it's darker outside, right? It's not as bright. Does that happen more up there than it does down here?
There is some evidence that as you get more towards the poles, the North Pole or the South Pole, that you're going to see more seasonal depression. For a city like Seattle, it's tricky because they'll have shorter days and lousy weather during the winter. So you can't really disentangle them. But there are enough studies that at least I'm pretty convinced that the closer you are to the poles as opposed to the equator, the higher the incidence of true seasonal depression.
So when it comes to weather then, and the gloomies, as you say, and by the way, it's been extraordinarily wet and cloudy and below average temperatures for the past 3 months, at least here in Southern California. So when you look at all of that, how do you describe it? Have you seen people say or come in complaining of depression, of gloomy, I don't feel right because this weather just isn't right?
Yes. And of course, the people who see me are already struggling with things like depression. Whether people who are vulnerable to depression are more sensitive to environmental changes, relatively colder, relatively grayer, relatively rainier environments, is not so clear. But I think those are really more transient effects as opposed to, let's say, a true seasonal depression. Because again, in Southern California, we'll have 2-3 days of rain, at least this year we have, and then you'll have a beautiful, glorious day. And so it's not like the unrelenting gloomy weather. And I think that's an important distinction.
So you're saying the fact that it's broken up, these atmospheric rivers, as it were, as those were coming through, right? It's 3 days of rain, and then we get sunny for 3, 4, 5 days, maybe sometimes a week or longer, and then it rains again, as opposed to if you're in a Seattle. That's something different, right? I mean, you can't really prescribe something for that because California is different, and you get the sunshine. That's the medicine.
That's correct. And what you could always do, of course, on those nice sunny days in Southern California, you could go outside. So as an example, one of the treatments, it's not the only treatment, but the most kind of unusual or interesting treatment for true seasonal winter depression is a light box. And it's a box that specifically delivers full frequency light at a relatively high intensity. You sit in front of it for 30 minutes. So if someone really is sensitive to light dark cycles and or gloomy days, they could easily just buy a light box and turn it on in the morning for 30 minutes on those gloomy days. But if you walk outside on a sunny day in Southern California, you're getting much more light than in fact you would in a light box. Our sun in Los Angeles is very sunny on light days, much more than you'll, again, get from any of those light boxes.
Is that what you would prescribe to people who maybe are feeling a little sad because of all this rainy weather, again, happening tonight and tomorrow, and just either get a light box or wait for the next sunny day here in Southern California?
I think those would be the two reasonable options. Nobody has really studied whether the use of a light box for occasional rainy gray days works. but it certainly isn't going to hurt. It's very benign. They're not expensive, easy to do. So if you feel like you're really sensitive to that, to those changes, that would be a pretty reasonable investment. They're not expensive, and you could use them on the gray days.
Dr. Michael Gitlin, professor of clinical psychiatry over at UCLA. Doctor, thanks for coming on and talking with us about it.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, a check-in with LA County's new sheriff in town, Robert Luna. We're going to talk to him tomorrow. And to be able to do interviews and stories just like that, it takes a lot of effort and, yes, money. Your support of KCRW powers the reporting we do on Greater LA. It's how public radio works. So we're asking for you to give during this spring pledge drive at kcrw.com/give. You could win Apple's very latest iPhone 14. If you donate today only, you'll have terrific odds as we enter you into that sweepstakes, kcrw.com/GLA. And while you're there at the website, drop us a line, share a story you think we should tell, and share your thoughts too. Tell us what's on your mind. Grab the podcast at kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zeke Reed, Phil Richards, John Meek, Sonia Geist, Danielle Chiriguayo, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordall all helped assemble this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your time, your ear, and of course your support. Have a great night.